Patrick Gonzalez.
Here.
Marsha Harvey. Glenn Harvey is excused. Tina Keener.
Here.
Byron Newman.
Here.
Dick Verduin.
Here.
We have a forum, so.
Okay, thank you. Welcome to April 6, 2016 CAC agenda. We have a agenda for us, we need a motion to adopt the agenda.
Motion.
Second, by Terry.
Yeah, I just want to, put a marker, I have a comment at the end. There's a space for marker comments, I'd like to make a comment.
Okay.
Well, you have a little,
Well, I just want to, often they just adjourn.
Okay.
You can shut up, get out.
Any other additions, deletions, or requests on the agenda, seeing none, call the question, all those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed, motion carries unanimously. Next item, 1C, the motion to approve the minutes of February 3rd, which we deferred at the last meeting to, address Myron's concerns about the taping of the meetings and, the summary of the meeting that we held on March 2nd.
Move approval of the minutes.
I'll second.
I don't know whether the summary, does the summary need approval?
No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
Not so much. Myron, there was a discussion about the.
Can you ask something?
Yes.
Yes. There was a discussion about the taping of the minutes and if it was a requirement.
Yeah, I read it.
Okay, so you read it, and are you?
What am I gonna do?
Well, we just wanted to make sure that you were held at the last meeting, wanted to make sure that you were, that your concern was properly addressed, and we put off the approval of minutes till today for that very reason.
Okay, thank you.
I lost my spot now, where it was.
Still, if it's necessary, it applies.
No, I was just, I was reading it specifically. Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any additions, deletions, revisions, seeing none, call the question, all those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed, motion carries unanimously. Okay, comments from the chair, I think I just made some of those. 1E, CAC liaison's report.
Okay, just, I handed out to everyone our public inquiry report. So I just, I pulled up kind of all the little stuff and just added a couple new. So if you have any comments or questions, we don't really get a lot of phone calls from the public, but we do put them on here.
Well, yeah, go ahead. The vast majority of them, if you could say that there's, are about quiet zones. So, I mean, this is obviously something that's very important to citizens, and maybe at some time or other, we can have a conversation about quiet zones here. I mean, that's the reason I really asked to keep track of these things, so we can see what citizens are interested in, and we should be better informed about what citizens are interested in, and not only that they are interested, but knowledgeable about the issue.
Well, I guess that leads into my next part of the report. So the quiet zone funding agreement between DOT and Albert Porter, Go Bright Line, has been executed, so they are now allowed to start construction of the quiet zone improvements. Go Bright Line just had their station kickoff event last month, at the end of the month. And just so you guys are aware, we had a quiet zone meeting the end of March with FRA staff, and then, you know, all the South municipalities are involved. So from West Palm down to Boca Raton. And basically it's to make sure that they're, you know, in line with filing their notice of intent to actually establish quiet zone. So in April, that's our targeted guideline for for all the municipalities to submit their letters, and they submit those to, you know, FRA, FDOT, they copy FEC on it, so that's moving ahead pretty well. Are there any questions, any other questions on kind of Glide Road right now?
You might want to give an update about phase two, since questions are coming in, that's in the date of this week.
Okay. So for phase two, the MPO has, we identified areas where we, you know, thought it was necessary to establish quiet zone with enough safety improvements. But FRA just approved FEC the right lines plans. So they have the 100% plans that were just approved. And yeah, you may have read it in the paper yesterday, right, Melissa?
Monday. Maybe it was yesterday.
So we're talking to the staff to find out, you know, what these plans mean. So right now we're thinking that the MPO will have to fund a very few additions, like two above what they've already proposed. So we're talking with them to find out what they're building. And part of the question for us, it's a little different from phase one, is they're proposing ASMs, or alternate safety measures. So in phase one, we were only allowed to use supplemental safety measures. So at the bottom of this quiet zone calculator says, to use ASMs, you have to get approval from the FRA. So we just need to have a little discussion with them to find out, you know, what do ASMs, how do they reduce the risk? And then what does that actually mean for the funding from the MPO? So
the only thing I would add is just the timeline has been pushed back because of financing. So the second phase of the quiet zones won't happen until all aboard goes forward with their second phase, which was projected to start in 2017, but now it looks like it can slide back because of their financing. So all of this was in the paper, and I think you're right, I think it was yesterday, or you can certainly go to their website. So quiet zones will happen when all of Ward Florida is ready to construct their second phase, so we're looking at 2017 or later to begin construction. So no relief anytime soon in the North County.
So they will be able to operate first phase, which is Miami to West Palm, without quiet zones? Is that the idea?
No, that's established. That's being constructed, like Luke said. The first phase that goes from Broward County up through the central or north end of West Palm Beach, that is funded. Those are being implemented. And when they begin their service, all of that will be in place. It's the questions we're getting from the North County. When do we get ours? When will we have a quiet zone? That's what was scheduled to start construction in 2017, and now looks like it will be pushed back even further because of the financing for the second phase.
But that doesn't affect the track construction itself. In other words, they would continue doing their double tracking in the right-of-way that they're requesting up to Orlando.
I don't think they're going to start doing any construction until they get
the financing. So that's my question, is in phase two, they're not going to do any construction until they get their financing?
That would be my understanding.
The train would only go to West Palm Beach and not to Orlando?
That's true.
That's what I understand.
That's why I don't want to talk too much about phase two, because I don't know that much.
I know. The other part of the question was, when they put the quiet zones in, will that be before they start running trains? You don't know that either.
That's our goal. Our goal is to have the quiet zones established before service starts for phase one, and we will look to do the same for phase two.
Yeah. And I think the interesting thing here is that quiet zones affect freight trains too.
Yes.
And so what the delay for quiet zones north of West Palm Beach means that the people will still will not have the benefit of quiet zones for the freight trains, even if the passenger traffic doesn't get to Orlando for a long, long time.
Well, again.
But south of West Palm Beach, people will have the benefit of quiet zones for both passenger and freight traffic.
Mm-hmm. Yes. All right. So Andy Delgado, our planner one, is currently at the National Safe Routes to School Conference in Ohio, and this is kind of in response to the state's statute that talks about hazardous walking conditions. So we've got our general planning consultant, Kim Lee Horn, on board, they're gonna be starting more sidewalk GIS layer and crossing guard GIS layer, so those two tied together. So PumpTrans underway with their major TDP update. There's a workshop at the PumpTrans Service Board meeting on April 28th at 1:30 at the Vista Center. At this meeting, it says they're compiling data and will be working to update their vision, goals, and objectives and policies in May. So if you're interested in that, it's April 28th at 1:30. The MPO is also kicking off their pedestrian and bicycle safety plan and will be forming an advisory committee. If anyone's interested in bike ped, Bruce, there you are. So April 1st, last Friday, was our deadline for TAP and local initiatives applications. So we received 7 TAP and 7 local initiative applications. And the TA applications go to the BGPAC, and staff is gonna be getting getting presentations from all the local initiatives applicants. So I received about $11.5 million in asks for local initiatives. So we've got some good projects, you know, the Congress Avenue in Delray. We got some stuff out in Wellington, and Indian Trail has submitted an application. Indian Trails Improvement District. So you brought up something interesting with the Microsoft Outlook 365. So the MPO sends out twice monthly MPO emails, like following the board meetings and stuff like that. So check your inboxes if you're not getting them. Melissa, are those sent from you or from info@MPO?
It will probably show up, the sender will probably show up as Palm Beach MPO, but it may have my address in parentheses, but it's going out through a distribution system. It's not me at my computer sending it directly. So please do let us know if by, say, Tuesday, if you haven't gotten a newsletter from us, please call me and we'll work out. Sometimes it probably doesn't happen as much with individuals, but some of the people who are employed by these municipalities that have super duper firewalls, sometimes we have to work with their IT people to make sure those things get through. So again, let us know if you don't get one, say by Tuesday. Our goal is to have it come out Monday.
All right, and then 3 project updates. The eastbound lane of State Road 80 Southern Boulevard at Benoist Farms has been closed because they're doing a gas line replacement. That's supposed to end on Friday. Construction for improvements at I-95 and Don Ross Interchange just began, and they're scheduled for completion in the summer of 17. And then the 50 bridge completion, I guess Nick got word that it's estimated for completion this spring of 17. So those 3 projects. And that's it. That's my report.
Okay. Thank you. Question. I'll make a comment on that. The email. Mine was going to Clutter. The Microsoft Clutter. So if you're using a service to send it out, what might happen if anybody's on the 365 in the Microsoft system, it automatically determines if you're going to want to read it or it's coming from one of these mass servers, and it automatically puts it in the Clutter. So if you're looking on your mobile device, you have to go into your Clutter folder and actually pull it out and then switch it over. And then by switching it over, it will know.
It should recognize it in the
Clutter
future.
The next time.
Yeah.
Just for anybody that's on that, any of the bigger systems.
So let's let the verbal record know that Bruce is here. Since we're all being taped.
Oh, you said 7 LIs and 6 taps?
7-7, I think.
7-7? Is that low?
For TAP, no, I think that's pretty on par, but it was low for local initiative this year. We got some feedback earlier. It's gonna be a topic in like October, December, when we go through the program updates again. Somebody commented that maybe, you know, we had a 5 million cap, we lowered it to 2.5. Maybe it needs to be raised a little bit to entice those cities. Because I had to drop out last minute, so.
They dropped out because?
They didn't submit because
yeah.
of the workload and other reasons.
Because the cap was lower?
Because they didn't think that it might be worth it.
Yeah. We're good. Oh, sorry.
Okay. All right, next on the agenda, the members of the public here, I don't see anybody here from the public that would like to speak. All right, not seeing any. Go through comment card. Action items. first action item Tuesday, the CAC bylaws.
Renee, I don't know if you want to touch on the bylaws since you took it to the board, but it might be quicker for you.
So we updated the CAC bylaws based on the MPO board's bylaws being updated. They weren't updated since 1986. So theirs went through a major overhaul. And so now all the committees are being updated to match theirs.
I'd just like to comment that I think they're an improvement. I thought that the former way of appointing membership was strange. That is, that our members were nominated by board members, but and our terms were coterminous with the board members' terms. And now it's a 3-year term, which I think is much better.
But I've never seen 21 members.
Well, we've right. never seen 21. That's also true.
I saw that one. Like,
yeah. I have a quick comment on G, where you talk about the Florida's open meeting law.
Okay.
This may seem kind of esoteric, but you talk about identifying a conflict of interest. Well, as I understand it, a conflict of interest must contain a financial conflict with a project that's being voted on. Like you own a construction company and someone's going to vote on granting that construction contract to the company. That any other conflict, because you don't want to vote, doesn't count.
I don't know. I'm not a lawyer.
I know. That's why I'm bringing this up, because there are plenty of people. I've served on a lot of boards. I even at one time was foolish enough to be an elected official. That people try to get out of not voting for other reasons. So they say they have a conflict, but it's not a financial conflict. They don't have a, no member of their family or them has a financial stake in the outcome one way or the other. And that's why I understood the way a conflict in Florida is supposed to work.
We can research that.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, the bylaws require, when you declare a conflict, you have to file a memorandum.
Yeah, but it could be, it doesn't have to be a financial, they're not saying it's a financial memorandum, conflict of interest.
Yeah. I guess the other question I have is whether, why it needs our approval since the board has already approved it.
Well, you can make suggestions, I guess, to edit it or additions or corrections if you see anything wrong in there.
No, let's clarify that item. So the description is pointing to the MPO governing board bylaws, which the governing board approved on March 17th. What we're now doing is looking at the document that governs the Citizens Advisory Committee, the bylaws for this committee, which is a separate document, and we're putting draft changes to that document in front of you for a recommendation of approval, so that the governing board can then adopt your bylaws to be consistent with their own.
Thank you for that clarification.
So the MPO board has not acted on your bylaws yet.
Okay. So, Gary, you have a chance.
Yeah.
Fix it up.
I don't have a conflict.
Well, it does. I mean, the question of conflict, we've talked about this in this committee over the years, and we don't file financial forms. So we and it's not at all clear. I mean, I can understand why somebody who has a conflict can say I'm conflicted and I shouldn't vote. I'm a little uncertain about filing a memorandum to, about it, because that puts then one's financial records in public record that we're not otherwise required to do. So, I mean, if I had my druthers, I'd strike that business about filing a memorandum.
I think I would agree. That's a lot of work that needs to just be disclosed.
The fact of the matter is, all we do is recommend things. We don't recommend awarding of contracts. We just approve. In an advisory capacity, we approve the stuff the staff has already done.
We're an advisory board by its nature, not a governing board.
Right.
It's hard to have a conflict of interest with an advisor.
Well, that's not entirely true. Just to review the record, I worked for 30 years under the Federal Advisory Committee Act. All advisory committees, but we have to disclose by federal law financial interests and all that sort of stuff. But that was all private, protected by the Federal Advisory Committee Act. And advisory committees can engage in conflict, but that kind of advisory committee, because those advisory committees were recommended where the federal government might spend its money. But in this case, we don't recommend specific funding opportunities. I don't see financial conflicts of interest arising in that nature. And since we're not required to disclose our financial interests as a condition of service, I'm a little concerned about whether people would actually declare a conflict if they had to put down in writing what that conflict was, and therefore exposed under the open meetings law their financial interests when they're not otherwise obligated.
Don't you guys have a lawyer?
We do, and she approved it, so. But I will go back to her and check, on your concerns. And come
well, why don't you tell us what you think it ought to be, and we'll carry that forward to the MPO board, unless the attorney says it has to be this way.
I would propose deleting the words, file a memorandum of voting conflict.
And you want to change,
I think it's sufficient.
Change the word report to disclose?
No, I think.
So shall disclose potential conflicts and recuse himself or herself from voting?
Yes.
On the
yes, I should say shall disclose that a potential conflict exists. Not necessarily what the conflict is, but that a conflict, potential conflict exists and recuse himself or herself from voting. And since that's on the public record and it's, heaven knows, it's being recorded and anybody can listen to it.
I agree with Myron on that one.
So,
I think those are good comments, yeah.
Your bylaws. Very good comment.
I'll move that the bylaws be amended by striking the word report in section G, at the end of the first line of section G, and replace it with disclose the existence of, and then in addition strike the words file a memorandum of voting conflict.
Do we have a second?
Second.
Continue. Okay. Any comments? Okay. Any other discussion? So we're ready to call the question. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Okay, next up on the action items, Glades Road, I-95 interchange.
So with us today, Adolfo Gomez with DOT and Lucas Costa with AECOM. And I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name earlier.
John Cabrera.
AECOM.
I'm like,
back up to 1995.
Well, then fix it. You just go back one and there it doesn't.
You know what I mean? Like the wasn't.
Yep.
I was getting worried there for a second.
That's what I want, just here.
Thanks for having us. My name is Louis Costa. I'm consultant for the Department of Transportation on the I-95 at Yates Road project. Fausto Gomez is the project manager for the Department of Transportation, and with me is John Arrieta, who's a traffic engineer. So with that, I kind of want to give you a brief overview. Most of you are familiar with the corridor. The limits of the project are from just east of the Town Center Mall, it's called Butts Road, all the way to the easternmost entrance to Florida Atlantic University. And there are several developments in the area of importance, including University Commons, the Boca Raton High School, Town Center is just off the screen here, and then Florida Atlantic University, and the city of Boca Raton has their water treatment facility right next to the project. There was a PD&E study that was completed in 2009. That's a project development and environment study that addressed I-95 main line from south of Gates Road to south of Linton Road. And as part of that study, they evaluated capacity improvements on Gates Road. So that concluded with a recommendation to expand Gates Road to 8 lanes, which is 4 lanes in each direction. That would have addressed traffic concerns, but it has significant impacts that I'll get into on this following slides. Obviously, the advantage was it opens up flow much better for traffic, but there were numerous disadvantages, including right-of-way requirements on both sides of the road, just west of I-95. This is a business area and a commercial area that includes restaurants and retail, parking would have been impacted, etc. East of I-95, you have Boca Raton High School, which would have required a strip of land right next to a football field, parking impacts on the University Commons, and impacts to the City of Boca Raton facility. So that, in conjunction with major power line impacts, there's a line that goes from the south side of the road west of I-95 that would have cost millions of dollars to relocate if we expanded the way the PD&E proposed. There was also a need to introduce 3 new bridges based on the concept that the PD&E had of reconfiguring the interchange at an additional cost and minor benefit to the overall project. And that would have meant also reducing the radius of these loop ramps. You can see the existing ramp compared to the proposed new ramps would have been even smaller, and there's already a documented concern with those radiuses being so tight that vehicles are off tracking. They've had to put high friction course pavement to try to address that situation.
Just bank them more.
Well, they're already at the maximum super elevation, which is 10%, so they already look like NASCAR. And finally, we've already presented this concepts to the city of Boca Raton. They like it because they actually had passed a resolution against the 8-lane section a while back. There was some concern with it. If you allow me, I'll give you a brief overview of what we're proposing compared to what the opinion was. First and foremost, the section view of the bridges crossing 95 would be maintained as a 3-lane section. We're introducing the buffered bike lanes, 7, they're wider. They provide a 20-inch separation from the vehicles. And we're also putting the sidewalk on the inside of the ramp so that they never have to cross a ramp pedestrians. And I'll show you a few more details on that in a future slide. The west area, we're zooming into the west area. Here's Butts Road, here's Town Center. As you come in through the west, this area would just simply be resurfaced, and the turn lanes, the left turn lanes to Executive and to Butts Road would be extended a little bit to accommodate more traffic so that it doesn't block the through traffic. but it would be simply a resurfacing. As you get further west, we would introduce this entrance ramp to I-95, both southbound and northbound. This ramp would be physically separated from through traffic on Glace Road, so you don't get that weaving motion of cars trying to cut in at the last minute. And you can see the ramp terminating in the southbound direction, or continuing across 95 and going northbound. And in this whole area, we introduce a physical separation, so again, the weaving gets eliminated. On the east side, as you're coming from the east, we introduce what's called an auxiliary lane, which basically eliminates a merge that occurs here right now, which creates a big bottleneck. As people come off of FAU, they have to merge onto the through lanes. And this bottleneck sometimes causes the intersection to get backed up and, you know, escalating the problems with traffic. So by keeping it open all the way to the entrance, here you have a choice of entering the ramp or continuing westbound on Gates Road, and it alleviates the traffic tremendously. So that's an important positive aspect of the concept. I-95 mainline is not affected by our project, but there's the Express Lanes project that DOT is pushing through all the way to Donald Ross. We looked at what that is proposing. It's not in conflict with our project, so I just wanted to show you that we're not in any way, shape, or form affecting what's coming in the future on 95 Express. This is interesting because you can see what the PD&E had proposed at the intersection of 15th Avenue and Airport Road is here. Here's the University Commons, the high school. This crossing would have been 187 feet long. I mean, that's huge for pedestrians. You need another green cycle just to let the pedestrians cross. And what that does is it introduces further delays for vehicles. Level of service gets worse. So it's all negative. What we came up with by introducing the elevation or a bridge over Airport Road for that ramp is we're able to keep that crossing small, requires much less of a green time, and it's much more pedestrian friendly. So that was one of the benefits. Another one is I talked about the reduced radius on the ramps. On our concept, we maintain or improve on the existing condition by keeping at least minimum FDOT criteria for those loops. Bicycle and pedestrians was very important too. We identified several locations where pedestrians are put in jeopardy because they have to follow the sidewalk and cross the ramp as vehicles are entering 95. So we've eliminated that condition in the proposed concept. And there's also a situation where the bike lane is asked to stay on the inside while cars are weaving with them to get on the ramp. In the proposed condition, that condition goes away. The sidewalk is in the middle, and there's no crosswalk, so there's no conflict point. It's been eliminated. And similarly with the bike lane, they're on the outside, and there's no conflict with vehicles.
At some point, there's a conflict, right?
At the end of the job, yes. And I'll show you some of the improvements that we're doing there as well. This would be a scenario here where you have, you can't avoid a conflict because they have to cross the ramp. So we're doing special emphasis, green bike lanes that kind of highlight the change of lane that needs to occur for the bicycles at those locations. Or this scenario where you introduce a right turn lane, you cannot avoid the fact that a vehicle is going to have to cross, so those are emphasized in green.
That's for the pedestrian, for the bicycle, right? For the pedestrian, the line of sight gets a lot improved on that condition, in that configuration.
Right here. This would be the pedestrian crossing. Line of sight is improved, and the width of the crossing is reduced as well.
And that's on the ramp going up I-95 north?
Yes. Yes.
And you expect people to stop?
No, they haven't entered the ramp yet. I mean, that's the entrance point of the ramp. That would occur. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I wanted John to walk you through the level of service issues, the traffic issues, so that you can see the comparison between the 8-lane PD&E section and this alternate option that we have. So we did a review of the analysis that was done with the PD&E, when the PD&E was first analysis was conducted. They did the analysis for the design hour, so only one period of the day. We did it now for the AM and PM because the characteristics of the traffic are different. During the AM, there's a lot of issues around this area, people trying to go to the high school. On the PM, the opposite happens where people coming from FAU are trying to get to I-95 and face other issues. So it was important to have that separate analysis. Also, during the initial analysis, Glades Road was proposed to be widened to 8 lanes, not only in this study area, but west of the study area all the way to 441. That being canceled. So volumes are, the projections are different. We still need projections for 2040. We do take into consideration also that before I-95 was planned to be expanded with general purpose signs, now we have a management, so those volumes are different as well. Now, in here you see the analysis done for the 4 lanes cross-section. Level of service D or better is green, level of service E is yellow, level of service F is red. You definitely want to order the F. And in general terms, you want your intersection as an overall level of service to be D. If you're going to notice, once I changed, this is the PD&E concept summary. There are no significant changes with the preliminary concept that we have developed. And we do this while we're keeping a general cross-section of 6 lanes. One of the improvements that we have is that instead of adding lanes at this intersection, as you see here on the PD&E, look at the number of lanes that you have on the westbound approach. It's not only one more lane for two traffic, they also have an additional 3 lanes on this side, and actually one additional lane here. That's where the 187 feet came from. We get there at the 3 lanes, but what we do is we have a gray separation. For that, then that allows us is to take a significant amount of traffic over 1,500 vehicles out of the intersection. When we do that, then we can redistribute the green time on the intersection to all the other movements. Another thing that we've done in this concept is that because of the low amount of green time that the northbound approach had, they needed 3 lanes to make the left turn movement in order to get to I-95. I-95 traffic is about 50% of the vehicles coming out of 15th Avenue. What we've done is we have transferred, they no longer make the left turn in order to make to go into I-95. What they do is they go to the intersection and at a new intersection here up north, make an almost U-turn, and then they decide to go anywhere for north or south. The improvement in this here is because through movements have better capacity than the left turns. Plus, once they have been here, they get a significant higher amount of green time. There's only a two-phase signal here while they are reversing other movements on Glades Road, the true movement. So they said if they get 10% of the green time in here, then they're gonna get they could get as high as 50% of the green time in here. That's why we were able to reduce the number of lanes just to one lane here to make that green time.
So you're banking everybody that's coming out of Whole Foods or shopping in there, they're gonna go straight across and then make a U-turn?
Everybody that is coming today out of Foods in this driveway that they have in here, and want to go to I-95, yes, which is about 200 to 300 vehicles on the morning, which they probably also include the traffic from the high school. That's actually a lot of the traffic in the morning.
So you can still make a left there, but that would be to go westbound on Glades Road.
Right, you can't do that.
Right.
So coming out there, you could also go east and make a U-turn and try to come back, but
you can always do
that's getting more and more difficult also.
Correct, right. This will be probably better at that. And again, if you see the one location that we're going to have a lesser volume, is a lesser level of service, but we are borderline level of service DE, is in here, as our one approach. But you see here, they have four lanes on each direction, which allow them to provide more green time for the southbound ramp. We cannot do that because we have three lanes. We did look into having a free flow lane, but in order to accommodate bicyclists and pedestrians better, we decided that, okay, a lower level of service would be okay. We have adjusted by creating additional storage on the southbound lane to ensure that vehicles will not queue all the way to I-95. It's a trade. So that's what we have. And then, as we mentioned, the last thing I want to mention is that in here, this is level of service E. If you notice, a level of service E. However, that analysis, because of the limitation of the methodology, then, it doesn't include when a pedestrian makes a call to cross the gateway and gets the time extended for them to be able to cross. We have to do that analysis separate. And when we do that, then basically this goes into level of service F. And not only at this intersection, but what happens is, like, when you have an emergency vehicle going through an intersection, or when you have a railroad crossing, that for the next three or four cycles, traffic needs to adjust. So they're going to create a backup in here, and that's probably what you have seen already today, when these queues go all the way to I-95 from time to time. But other than that, we're basically achieving comparable level of services with a cross-section that has 6 lanes for safety.
What prompted this? Was it because of the backup at 95?
It's traffic congestion. I mean, that was the purpose and need of the project. This is an interchange improvement project, so the goal, the DOT's goal was to eliminate impacts to the main line caused by these ramp terminals and these adjacent intersections. It's called the interchange area of influence. So as a result of that, you know, improvements have to be made to the arterial, but they're all tied to the ultimate goal, which is improving flow on I-95.
And the original project was actually part of the Spanish River interchange. It was all tied together. Right. The opposition to the A lanes separated this project from the other one that we went ahead, and that's what we consider a different configuration.
Which I assume that will take a lot of this congestion off of blades, or the pressure off blades.
We consider that as part of the traffic analysis, yes.
Except during games.
It's yet to be. The good thing is, Spanish River will be completed way before we get to construction of this one, so we could adjust the traffic model with actual figures. Right now, it's all forecasted numbers that, you know, are an estimate. But, you know, bottom line, what I wanted to highlight here, these two exhibits have very little deviation in terms of level of service. The big difference is this concept requires 8 lanes, and this one doesn't. So with much less impacts, we are achieving very similar level service. So it was a well-received concept.
Do you have a budget?
In terms of budget too, I mean, the cost, we're at the very early stages of design, so we haven't done a detailed cost estimate, but we can tell you that it's gonna be a lot less than the PDME concept that had 3 additional bridges, widening for 2 miles on both sides of the road, you know, more impact. So this project is probably going to reduce that cost by maybe $8 to $10 million. So we're in the acquisition. Yeah, right away acquisition too.
What is the cost of the Spanish River? That's a huge cost.
That's not my project, but I think it's in the neighborhood of $100 million.
Yeah.
But this is the last thing I wanted to show you, and it's a view looking west of Glades Road as you approach Airport Road, and that's what this elevation would look like. As you can see, there's not much
to look at other than I-95 and the water treatment plant, and the new concept, we're going to introduce some landscaping in this area if we want to beautify. So it's not that much of a, you know, visual impact.
And the bike and sidewalk would go up that bridge?
No. That, we're not showing the proposed roadway here, but the bike and sidewalk would be here and stay on that side unopposed to ramp traffic, which is another improvement from the original design. The PG&E had the pedestrian side on the ramp. On the ramp, we have moved away from that.
Why is that?
You don't want the conflict on the pedestrians with the vehicle going to I-95.
But it's on the left and you do a protected bike lane. You go along the whole stretch of it, right?
No, because you still need to be, you still need. Well, let me show you what that looked like, because this is the, in the PG&E concept, the bike lane goes right there. And in the bike and the sidewalk goes back here. So the sidewalk is, let me see if I can show them what happens. As you get to the ramps, the sidewalk is here.
I understand.
And that crosses. So the other one was another view from the University Commons, looking at the intersection, and that's what that elevation would look like. We presented this to the city commission, city staff, department personnel, and it's been very positive. We do not anticipate the opposition from any group. Everybody that brought this up to is in favor of it.
So tell us again how safe it will be for pedestrians to cross here, because that the University Commons is over here, right?
That's right.
And so people.
So the crosswalk I show you would be what replaces this one, right? And yeah, that's in plan B.
I mean, it's feasible to get across. You're saying it has to be double the cycle?
Well, no, this one would be comparable. As a matter of fact, we can give the pedestrians more green time because, well, not only are we maintaining the width, but by taking a large amount of traffic away from the intersection, there's more green time to distribute.
Right.
You know? So it's good for vehicles, it's good for pedestrians. In the other scenario, you give them as much green as you can before the intersection fails, and what you have is you got to run to cross the street.
Yeah, which some of us can't do. But will people still be able to make a right-hand turn there?
Yes.
So they're still having potential conflict with pedestrians and vehicle traffic.
Like I
see that all the time.
And some, and I know exactly where you're coming from, some drivers in South Florida don't understand that they don't have to ride away.
Yeah.
When they're making a right turn, the pedestrian is doing. That's an education problem more than that.
And the other question I had was about the right-of-way. You possess all of this right-of-way now for the ramps and everything?
Except for...
Because you showed a big, wide, grassy area.
All the right-of-way that we need for this project is a narrower strip in front of the water treatment plant, which the city is willing to give to the department, this public land on both sides. Everything else has been eliminated as far as right of way needed. So all the right of way that was needed here is gone. Same with this. There was right of way needed here.
And you own that right of way that
butts
out on the right side of
Yeah. This is limited access right of way from the interchange. So DOT owns all the way to here.
And on the other side of the road where the green is, trees are?
Same
here. They're right in there.
They own all the way to the yellow there.
Ah, that's great.
Yeah. So, this?
To Mr. Brown's point about the intersection at airport, are there signs that could be posted above the light that warn vehicles that are turning right to yield to pedestrians?
Yeah,
I think we have, this one was a schematic sign only.
No, she's talking about pedestrian, due to pedestrian signs. Those would be
the there are different signs that we can use to emphasize, you know, even a no turn on red if necessary and if it can be done. But yeah, there's many options that can be implemented to enhance safety.
The only thing that concerns me is obviously we've got university, we've got high school, and this thing doesn't look to be completed until 2040. Right?
No. 2040 is the forecasted traffic volume. We would be probably 2018, 2020 construction, and then those numbers are still viable 20 years in the future.
I understand. Because, you know, we always look at different ways to handle like pedestrian and bike traffic. And this seems like the bare minimum, and I love the 7-foot bike lane, you know. Mm-hmm. Are we potentially, you know, is there any way we can push the limits on making sure that it's even safer with respect to pedestrians and bicyclists? I know you put some things in there. I love the green colored lanes. I think we need to do more about, you know, educating the drivers, and we do that through visual, you know, tools on the streets. But, you know, throughout the U.S. and throughout the world, there's a lot of really cool things that are being implemented to be able to make the two kind of coincide, if you will. So, you know, are we looking into things like that, or are we just kind of taking what, you know, FDOT and what have you as in their plans?
It's not quite that dry and cut. I mean, yes, we're doing what DOT criteria for bike lanes allows. DOT has gone above and beyond. They're actually reducing the width of the lanes to provide that 7-foot buffer bike lane, and that's now criteria, so now we can implement it. But the difficulty with this location is that it's within a limited access facility. This is I-95, so we, you know, DOT doesn't, their priority is the regional transportation facility, and because of what the arterial is doing to 95, we have the extra funding to go outside the limits of 95 and do some improvements. But, you know, that's the logic that has driven the project. And, you know, I don't, if you have some ideas, I'd like to hear them, but maybe we can introduce into the project. But the goal has been, you know, to improve mobility, number one.
Okay. Sure.
Obviously, if you do have some ideas, I'll give you my card, send me an email.
Okay, great.
Could I ask a quick question about the lane? You showed the I-95 lane width at 12. Is that the standard?
Yes.
And then on the surface road, it's 11?
Yes.
Is that the minimum, 11?
11 is the minimum for a state road.
Yeah.
They used to be 12, but in order to introduce wider bike lanes, they've gone to 11 foot on existing facilities.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I thought. Okay.
That's typical. We look like that. And on the main line,
it's probably fanciful to talk about speed limit. Yeah. I'm glad it's real here. But when a lane is reduced from 12 to 11, is there a requirement to reduce the speed limit?
No, it's an urban arterial has a 45 mile an hour posted speed, which means we designed it to 50 and posted to 45.
And 11 foot lane should be.
It still meets the speed criteria.
Anybody else have any other questions?
The last slide you have that showed the proposed with the ramp and all that, mm-hmm. I think those are wonderful visualization tools.
Yeah.
I would just encourage you, if you could, to add something to the title, because a lot of people will look at these presentations once they're posted to our website, and without the benefit of hearing the audio in sync with it, they won't know if they're looking at something existing, something that's definitely going to happen, something that's just an idea. So if you can maybe,
rendering.
A couple of slides, rendering a proposed or something like that, I think would be very helpful.
I love these slides. They really help you visualize what it can look
like. Looking at these in advance, it was extraordinarily confusing about what was old and what is new.
Yeah.
If you even put old and new.
Proposed. Existing and proposed.
Computer renderings are getting so good that they almost look real.
Absolutely.
I like a bike lane on the bridge, just sort of down the hill to ride up to Florida.
Yeah, and this was done as a very preliminary concept because we didn't render what's going on Gates, and you know, because it was a kind of a rush to get the concept. The idea for this rendering was simply to show the proportion of the bridge with respect to the roadway, but the finished rendering would have all the different lane configuration, all the new striping, the bike lanes, etc.
Did you notice the shade by the palm tree up against the bridge? And what time is it?
The exasperating shade.
Yeah, the one I like is the airplane.
Yes.
That guy. That's not there in the real picture. So somebody got the...
Any other questions? We have, as an action item, a motion to recommend endorsement of these proposed improvements for Glades and I-95.
This will,
You have a motion?
I was going to say, so move.
Motion
by Ed. I'll do the second.
Second by Terry. Any further discussion? I have one. Is this another $100 million in that area?
No. No. It's probably going to be... Between 35 and 45.
I was going to ask if you guys knew that. Yeah, next year.
That doesn't work out there for 20 years.
I'm sorry?
Do you know the FM number?
The FM number?
Yeah.
412-420-4.
Okay. Got it. Same one. Got it.
And don't quote me on 35 to 45.
No, I'm just asking. No, I know.
Yeah, the cost.
I think that's a question.
It's on the recording.
Sometimes I get in trouble because there might be a reporter from the newspaper.
It's too early. Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Call the question. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great presentation.
Okay. Did you do that right there with Valerie?
We did a Transit Tuesday, so we all took
transit one day to get to work, even Lou, who came from up north.
Took a bus from Martin.
took a little while to get here, but it was.
Did you hear that?
It was an 80-mile round-trip bus ride, so it was definitely pretty cool. I got to ride over, yeah, U.S. Mexico Jupiter Lighthouse. It was probably the best bus ride of anybody.
That's a nice experience for us, ride. Also, the Department of Environmental Resource Management did an organized bike-to-work day ride. These are some pictures right here. They biked 10 miles each way to and from work. They met up in Palm Beach Gardens and then took these back roads, back paths to get here. So that was, they had a lot of fun doing that. And then also, it wasn't on an actual work day, but the mayor of Boca Raton, our RPO board chair, also organized a ride in Boca Raton. So those were just some highlights. And then we had this past weekend our culminating event. We closed down Flagler Drive in front of the West Palm Beach Green Market. We had a bunch of booths to educate people on bike and ped safety, as well as transit programs here, and did a transportation scavenger hunt. I just want to show you a couple pictures of that. This was a bike rodeo that YMCA did, and we had Sky Bike there, lots of informational booths. And we also had FDOT and Walker, their mascot, there. So kids were really excited about that, and we did our awards ceremony. So we had the top team in each business size category. For the extra large business size, Palm Beach County School District did awesome. They had a ton of teachers participate in carpool, transit, all kinds of stuff. So, and we also had the Environmental Resource Management Department. They were our large business winner. And then Pilsen and Marlin Engineering, they are one of our consulting teams. So they actually won for the medium-sized business. And then Tri-Bike Run was a bike shop in Jupiter. All their employees biked to work. And Ray Riders was a group of teachers from an elementary school in Belgrade that carpooled a lot. So they won for that. And then our top commuters, our top commuter was a guy named Louis Lucas. He likes to go by Luke. He's from the city of Delray Beach, and he biked almost 1,300 miles for work. And we had to call the city of Delray Beach and ask them, are they all work miles? Is this for real? And they were like, yeah, this guy lives in Loxahatchee. He bikes 28 miles each way to work every day. So props, kudos to him. And then second, yeah, this guy right here.
And he's not a young guy.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
He's in great shape.
He works two jobs, and one of his jobs in the city of Delray Beach 4 days a week, and then I forget what the other job was, but he was hardcore. And then we had the second and third place top commuters were two employees from the school district who also, they did over close to 1,000 miles of pounds of CO2 saved, but they did over 2,000 miles by bus, train, and carpool. So we had a lot of people commuting from far away here to Palm Beach County. One of them lives in Miami Lakes and took bus and train to get out to like Belgrade. Okay, so it was intense. We had some really good social media coverage. This is a snapshot of our Instagram feed, hashtag PB Commuter Challenge, and then some photos from our event from some of our partners. And just, we sent out a survey to the folks that participated to see what their thoughts were on the commuter challenge so far. We've received 24 responses, and we asked them, as a result of this challenge, which of the following forms of transportation did you take that you would not have normally taken? And we had about 41% said that they took the bus, and they normally wouldn't have taken that. 33% biked, and they wouldn't have normally done that. 8% took the train, and they wouldn't have done that. And 29% carpooled when they would have done that, and then 25% walked. So that's good to know, because it did encourage people to take alternative modes. We also asked them how often are they going to continue to take alternative modes of transportation after this ends. 50% said occasionally, 16% said frequently, and 25% said rarely, and 8% said that it didn't change, influence their transportation mode choice. So.
Is there already a commute?
Yeah. And then, so we asked them what did they like about the challenge in general. People were pretty happy overall. They were encouraged to try alternative modes of transportation. They liked that it was a workplace team, so it promoted team building. They liked the website, the leaderboards, their ability to track pounds of CO2 saved, and they had fun. So overall, it was good. And we, last but not counties, we asked them, will you participate again? And 100% of the people said yes so far. So that's just a recap, and we hope to do it again next year. So if you participated, help us spread the word. Thank you.
I'm surprised to see 100% say yes. So
yeah.
There's a little love.
So
thank you.
Sure.
So quick question on the bicycles that are downtown, the blue ones. Is anyone actually using them from Tri-Rail? Do you know? I saw them today when I came here. It was
the Skybike?
Old, beautiful back of them. Looks
yeah,
like
yeah. I've heard that there's pretty good participation and people that use it because you can connect to and from. So.
Well, Tri-Rail has those bike lockers at the stations.
For your
but they have a whole row of them on the just right on the other side of
right
the street.
Right next to those Tri-Rail station, yeah. There's a station.
We have to look up the.
Is someone keeping track of that? I mean, in the city, are they?
The company.
Skybike, yeah,
like,
the company.
Yeah.
They were one of our prize sponsors, so we gave actually that guy our top commuter one month pass, this Skybike. So on his way to Delray, he can hop on another bike, I guess. So, yeah.
Okay. Any other questions by the members? Seeing none, we have the summary points of the March 17th meeting. Anybody have any comments, questions? All right, seeing none, take us to the administrative items, member comments, and then Mr. Myron.
I have a comment.
Has one?
Yes.
That's a comment.
Go ahead. I would like to propose a request that a subject be brought to discussion at this committee before push comes to shove. So that we're better educated about it. And the subject is driverless cars, driverless vehicles. There is a company in
Driving System.
Big part of
the system.
Driverless vehicles.
Okay.
There is a company in Palm Beach County that is working on developing a driverless system, basically a driverless Uber type system. And they've been working on this for 3 or 4 years, and one of the principals tells me they're within 2 years of rolling this stuff out. Driverless vehicles imply that there's certain important issues. One is the technology, whether the driverless, the passenger in a driverless vehicle can override in an emergency the driverless system, or whether there's absolutely nothing in the car or the vehicle that will allow the driver to, passenger to overrule. There are liability issues, there are issues of integrating driverless vehicles into the fleet. There are a whole mess of interesting problems. And I would like to suggest that bit by bit, maybe 10 minutes here, 10 minutes there, we get informed about that by bringing in people who know something about it or have thought about it. I've spoken with one of the principals of this company. They said they'd be delighted to come in and talk about their plans. There are three principals. One is a former real estate developer. Another is a person who was involved with GM's driverless car program and Google's driverless car program. So these are serious people. The other is Jeb Bush, and it's the only commercial venture that he did not evolve himself from when he ran for president, which is really quite interesting. So this may be coming, and it's a really
sounds like an assignment for Luke to do some research for it.
So well, I was going to let him finish up and then.
Well, the fellow who's proposing this stuff is willing to come in and talk to us.
Okay.
Then it might seem that we, based on that, at some other time we might have somebody come in and talk to us about liability issues or other legal issues related to this that have to be overcome, or maybe somebody's thought about how these things would be integrated into the system. I can tell you that the guy wants to push this out in a gated community, where the vehicles would be
circulating within the gated community of people who don't have cars or don't want to drive, can call on their phone for a car, the car will come for them, take them wherever they want to go, on demand. And then he wants to expand it out into a commercial area adjacent to this gated community, and then eventually to all of the northern Palm Beach County. That's their plan. And it has interesting, there are interesting aspects of it and there's serious implications for the transportation system. And, you know, people who are involved in driverless cars think that, you know, in 10 years, as the fleet turns over, which is going to take more than 10 years, of course, but there are interesting transitions coming. And I thought it would be, I mean, I'd like to be better informed on this, and I would think that this would be of interest to our committee and get us a little bit ahead of the game.
So I'll get your contact information off the record. Yep. So no free advertisement. But so I was invited to go to an automated vehicle presentation. It was end of last month downtown, and I couldn't go out of the conflict. But I'm pretty sure George Webb is like a member of that committee, so he might be a great resource for me to tap and say, can I get some presentation materials from you? But definitely, I mean, I'm interested in it. I don't know if everyone else is, but.
Yeah, sounds cool.
I can give you the contact information for.
What? For your contact, yeah.
I'm ready to stop driving.
I think we need a bigger question for the committee. We're overseeing a 25-year billion-dollar road and transportation improvement plan, and I think we all know the autonomous vehicles are coming, but we don't have anything that's integrated autonomous vehicles into this billion-dollar road program, and what are the impacts of autonomous vehicles? Where is it going to start? I think it's logical for a country club to have yet a couple cocktails. Hey, just wish you Uber app,
right.
Picks you up, and boom.
Right.
I use it all the time, especially when you travel. It's easy. It's fast. You don't know who's driving, but at least it's a person at this point. So I think it's that big picture. What are the transportation impacts, capacity, volume, safety? So all the retired husbands are going to be out of a job.
So I remember seeing one report that came through, and it was like a nation, you know, one of the research think tanks, and from the nation, only one MPO had like the words autonomous vehicles in their LRTP, and I think it was Jacksonville. But it's definitely, I think, going to be on the radar for the next LRTP, and there's just different technologies. Like there's something that can sense the, you know, million miles where you don't need infrastructure to drive these cars. I think there's two competing technologies, but. So it's definitely interesting
to use the word autonomous because there's cars today that will stay in their lane and they'll brake automatically. You don't
it's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's still about one of the higher ones, the higher price vehicles today, and it's amazing what it does. I mean, it might actually save your life.
I might want to say, as far as one of the states that in which driverless vehicles are now legal,
they're being tested by DOT, I think.
Yeah.
The Florida's because it's flat. That's why we're a good test bed.
And there are articles on the liability that,
you know,
the vehicle is still responsible for, and it becomes a liability of that. So it's you're right, it's a whole.
Yeah, I mean, people have been thinking about this stuff, but I think it would be, I mean, we're a citizens advisory committee, and I think that if we were better informed on all these things, we would be in a better position as we go forward for dealing with,
when we started the big picture, what are the DOT's plans for? What are the county's plans for? Maybe start at that level. What is the implementation plan for autonomous? And are we prepared? Are we not prepared? And then work our way down to the specifics of it.
Well, that's
so we're not spinning our wheels as to just more than we're actually looking at the big picture as to what the impact is. Is that agreeable? Or, I mean, you got to start somewhere. I mean,
right.
It's going to be lots of pieces, but I think.
I think that the committee is interested.
Autonomous.
I would say that if the committee is generally interested, that the chair of staff should figure out how to present them, what material to get and how to present it, and over what schedule of time, all that sort of stuff.
It might even be an additional item we need to put on our agenda. What are the impacts of autonomous? What is happening? What are the technologies?
hard to even go online and research it and see exactly what everybody is doing because they're still very protective of that. There are a lot of players in the auto, the big auto manufacturers are going to, not really manufacturing cars anymore, we are in manufacturing entertainment and capsule to encapsulate that person, that entertainment of that drive. So it's not even about transportation anymore, but capturing the person's attention. It's a whole different world. Okay? Well, sorry about that a little bit. That's a game twister, huh?
Another subject I'd like to put on the table eventually for consideration is adaptation for climate change, particularly with respect to storm surge issues and whatnot. I mean, the transportation system is going to be potentially significantly impacted by storm surge before sea level rise, but these are important issues for the future, and I'd like to be better informed about what the thinking is within the NPO and elsewhere about these matters.
Do you read my inbox? I got an email today. So I think Valerie and Frank, you posted on the climate.
Yeah, there's a climate change action partnership, and the NPO is listed on the committee. I want to say Natalie Schneider is kind of the go-to person from the Office of Sustainability at Palm Beach County. So she will probably be the first person to kind of bring in. We've been working with her a lot about what we should do in our long-range transportation plan to identify
and so our scoring system for local initiatives does take into account sea level rise.
Yes.
And I actually did see some preliminary graphics from, is it called slopes? It's basically like storm surge. It's basically
slosh.
So yeah, so we just saw preliminary images from slosh. So I think we're just going to have to ask that consultant for a presentation. So that's definitely a good topic.
And we do have a page on our website already, but it doesn't, at this point, it doesn't offer much more than the link to the county's resources and all that, but it's on our radar and we can always expand as we get additional information.
So would there be a possibility of having someone come to do a presentation here?
Yes,
absolutely. And that presentation is available, the PowerPoint of the last, call that they had about the slosh, the potential storm surge, or maps.
We can see if we can get the